Hey, everybody, welcome to the show and Happy New Year. Hope you guys are having a great 2018. Before we get to my guest, January 18th to the 20th, I'm going to be doing stand-up at the Comic Strip Comedy Club in Edmonton, Canada. I'm trying to find the coldest place on earth to do comedy. That's where I'm going to be. It's going to be outdoors in a bathing suit. No, it's going to be indoors. We think there's heat. Come on out. Great venue. I play it every year. January 18th to the 20th, Comic Strip Comedy Club, Edmonton, Canada, in the Edmonton Mall. You can get tickets by just Googling and going online for that. And my guest this week, Mr. Jeff Fager, executive producer of 60 Minutes. He has a new book out called 50 Years of 60 Minutes. It's a great book. Read it. Really, really well done. And a really cool conversation about the start of 60 Minutes, the history behind it, how the show has and continues to be the gold standard in television journalism, and how he runs that show and works with amazing people there to make that show what it is every week. So enjoy this conversation. I really did, and it's a really, really fascinating discussion. And hope to see you in Edmonton, Canada, January 18th to the 20th. Joining me is a return guest, former chairman of CBS News and executive producer of 60 Minutes, and my pal from The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, audience member, Jeff Fager. Hey, Jeff.
Hello, Paul.
Nice to have you back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm in your office, which I want to talk to you about in a minute, but I was waiting in the waiting room and I started looking at the pictures on the walls.
Yeah.
It's like a museum. It's the history. There's a shot of Morley Safer shooting pool with Jackie Gleason.
Yeah, there's a lot of history here.
Oh my God, it's so fascinating.
That's what you realize, I think, and what I realized in writing a book about it is that we touched a lot of history over half a century. And if that's your goal and you've lasted 50 years, it's amazing how much we touched. And
yeah,
and we try to put it on the walls. I mean, Alison Pepper works hard at that.
It's really, I mean, people should make an excuse to come have a meeting with you just so they could look at the walls.
Yeah.
You mentioned the 50 years, and you have a book out, 50 Years, 60 Minutes, and it is absolutely terrific.
Thank you.
Because you've done three things for me in this book. Everybody has their own takeaway on a book. First of all, you broke it down by decades, mm-hmm. which was really, really an interesting way to do it. It's a textbook, in a way, for journalism in terms mm-hmm. of how to make the gold standard of television journalism or journalism in general, how the show started and how you all sort of have made it and make it so great. But it's also a story about redemption, which I want to get to,
okay.
which it personalized it. And, you know, you stepped in for the great Don Hewitt mm-hmm. who created this mm-hmm. and Don had a bumpy road to get to where he did to create the show. And fill people in on that just a little bit.
You know, he was such an interesting figure, and he started at CBS right after World War II. Television was just starting, mm. and someone said, you know, you ought to consider getting into television, because he spent his whole life thinking about showbiz. You know, he was
right.
He really loved the idea of Broadway.
Right.
You know, and.
And why didn't he go that direction and more entertainment out of the box?
I think that this came up. Someone said, you should take a look. They're hiring people over at CBS television. It was brand new.
Oh.
And he went and he saw lights and he saw cameras and he got excited by it and it sucked him right in, you know. And what's so interesting about it is that under the same roof were the people who founded this corporation, this organization, CBS News, Ed Murrow and Fred Friendly. Mm. The kind of the founding fathers of CBS News.
They're called the Murrow Boys.
And right? the Murrow Boys. Yeah. And they had built it during World War II, covering the war so well on the radio. And so Murrow had built it with Fred Friendly. All of a sudden, CBS News was a real news organization on mm. the radio. Mm. Television was a gadget, didn't interest them at all.
Yeah. And I remember you saying, I saw a fabulous talk you gave here at CBS that they kind of looked down their nose at television.
Oh, yeah, they did.
Right?
Yes, they did.
And this is before television became really like an entertainment. I mean, just from a perspective of, no, we only do news through the radio and
yeah.
newspaper journalism, right?
Yeah, you don't have to go back very far to hear people criticizing the internet that way.
That's you know, really a good point.
Right around the year 2000, there's a quote in the book from the New York Times that accused us, 60 Minutes, of acting like the internet. For publishing, showing pictures of Jack Kevorkian putting a patient to death.
Wow.
and, you know, what is now accepted in five or six states.
It's using you as sensationalism.
Sensationalism, right? Like the internet.
Wow.
And so I do think that the Merle boys looked at television that way. And Don loved it. Don loved the idea. And while they're busy covering their stories and practicing great journalism on the radio, he was experimenting with ways television could be better at news, mm-hmm. and start to become more of, of broadcasting news, not just the radio. Anyway, he learned so much from watching them, but he wasn't one of them.
Right.
And he was actually a director on television. And, you know, as the 50s progressed, TV became a bigger part.
Right.
And they saw it as an opportunity to do great documentaries, and also started doing a lighter Murrow program called Person to Person, which was a lot of celebrity interviews.
Yeah, it's sort of a precursor to the long form interview that exists now. Yeah, it was really interesting.
But then they were doing really important things on television, like exposing Senator McCarthy for what he was in that era. And but anyway, Don became a big figure in the television side and directed the first Nixon Kennedy debate, which I think all of a sudden he is like peaking, you know, he's really become a big, and they made him the executive producer of the first half hour of the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
Big. That's big.
Very big. And
so now what I'm curious about in reading the book, you talk about this in the first chapter, like if he wasn't quite one of the Murrow boys.
Yeah.
He must have been so good that they were giving him this path, right?
Well, and they hadn't quite defined what the leadership of a television news broadcast should be.
But did they appreciate his leadership and him making these broadcasts as good as they were, or was he just looked at as a sort of a gatekeeper?
I don't think he ever really fit in with the Murrow boys. Mm-hmm. And so in 1964, when Fred Friendly became president of CBS News, one of the first things he did was to fire Don Hewitt from
that
job.
There's a great story, page four of your book. Quote, Friendly, on the other hand, considered Hewitt a flashy showman. Don didn't fit in his image of the leader of the news division's flagship broadcast. In 65, Friendly called Don into his office, blah, blah, blah. He was going to create a special unit just for Don, his own empire. Don was ecstatic. Don called his wife and a friend, and they both said, you just got fired. You weren't promoted.
Yeah.
And
at first he thought, wow, this is great. I've just been promoted. But no, Friendly fired him.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And he got stuck doing these dry documentaries.
Yeah,
right?
That he didn't like because he had a short attention span and he thought everybody else did too. And so he came up with this idea. Let's take three documentaries, cut them down to 15 minutes. And put them in 1 hour.
He felt like he was looking to do Life magazine.
Yes.
On TV. And for those of you listening who have no idea what Life magazine was, fantastic magazine that sort of captured newsmakers, celebrities in sort of a very sort of raw, sort of real way.
Yeah, and visual.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he wanted to do that. He wanted to what he called High Murrow and Low Murrow. You know, the really, you could put a story about a migrant worker or an interview with the president of the United States and mix it with an interview with Marilyn Monroe. That was his concept.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the part of the genius of it is this attention span thing.
Right.
The idea that one of the things we love about our broadcast to this day is there's usually a little bit of for everybody.
Yeah, there is
something for everybody. And
but also very often stories that you're not seeing anywhere else or done in a way you're not, which is very hard to do now because there's so many platforms.
We can talk about that too, Paul, because that's tricky, but it's, you know, it's part of the secret sauce. He really, the attention span thing is what's amazing because if you think about it today, the TED Talk is 17 minutes.
Right.
It's just a little longer than the 60 minute story.
Yeah.
But it works.
Yeah.
And it works on your mobile device.
Mm.
It works if you're waiting for a plane.
Mm.
You know, you can watch a 60-minute story. And I think that's why I'm excited about the future of the broadcast. That way, we translate well on your mobile device.
Well, and that goes to this idea of decades. And you broke the book up into decades.
Yeah.
And how do you feel the show has done in terms of adapting to the decade or the decade adapting to it?
Mm-hmm. Well,
and decade to get, how have how has the show changed decade mm-hmm. to decade in your mind?
Yeah, well, it's changed quite a bit. I mean, I think I talk about this a lot, the standards and the values that Don learned from Fred Friendly and Ed Murrow have not changed.
Yeah, Fred Friendly would say, don't talk down to right. the viewer, but don't assume they know more than you.
That's exactly right. And there are a lot of those things that come directly from Fred Friendly. And yet, with each decade, and I tried to capture this in the book, we did evolve. We changed.
You totally do.
Yeah. And, you know, some of it is who's running it, because there was a change when I took over, as there would be. Mm. I didn't want to just, you know, put my fingerprint on it. I loved what 60 Minutes was, but I also felt it needed to be more current, more newsy.
Right.
You know, decade earlier, Don and Mike decided, you know what, this whole business of ambushing people and hiding cameras, we're overdoing it just for the sake of the drama.
Right.
Let's get out of that.
Right.
So, you know, that's another example of how it's evolved. It has changed. You know, but again, people, I think, expect something from us, and they feel like they get it when they tune in on Sunday night.
When this is the redemption for me about the book and what you, so Don Hewitt is the Michael Jordan of broadcasting, and this is why, not because of his greatness, but because of the adversity that he overcame. You know, Michael Jordan didn't make varsity, and he
so
had
much
that
adversity
chip on his shoulder, which made him great. And I know Don, you know, he said, you know, he had something that he wanted to prove, you know, that he really kind of was going to, you know, show these guys, you know, that I deserve to be here. And
that he understood what they were talking about, what they represented.
Right.
In journalism.
But I think that this sort of firing, if you will, and then him coming back was made him make sure that he made a very high quality broadcast. I'll show these guys.
Yeah, I totally think
and
so.
And this is the part that you know, anything, this book has soul. It's not just a technical, like, this happened and then this happened. Yeah. And then here's an anecdote, which are great. It's like you can understand, like, this guy's fire.
Yeah.
And how it drove this and made this such an amazing show.
Yeah, it's such a good observation, because I think it's central to our longevity and our success that he really did. And I learned so much from Don Hewitt, and I learned so much from Don Hewitt about what he learned from them, which is really extraordinary if you think about it. That's 75 years passed down through a few people.
And there are times, you know, when he's wrong, he figures it out. I mean, initially he saw it as a single correspondent show.
Yeah.
And started with Harry Reasoner, hires Mike Wallace.
Yeah.
And you described Don and Mike as the Lennon and McCartney.
Yeah.
And then Morley Safer is George Harrison. And I love the description of George Harrison. And what did each bring in terms of the Lennon, McCartney, Wallace, Hewitt relationship? What did each bring to the table, and how did it complement each other?
You know, it's interesting, the personality of the program, that the 60 Minutes has a personality, and it's derived from those two. Hmm. And then Morley, because if you think about it, when they start, Mike brings the sort of tough questioning, the directness of our broadcast, which we still care about to this day. He was in everybody's face all the time. You know, Mike loved more than anything walking through an airport and someone shouting, you know, give him hell, Mike. That was like his favorite thing. And he
would steal stories from.
He was tough. He was feisty, and he was trouble. And, you know, that is definitely something that people associate with 60 Minutes.
Why put up with that as a producer? I mean, I've worked on TV shows, and I know talent sometimes, you know, you got to put up with, but obviously he was great, but I guess it was worth it.
No, I think a lot of people didn't put up with it. You know, the turnover rate in the mic shop was pretty high.
there you go.
There are a couple of people that I think stayed for a long time and did well with him because he respected them, and they were able to just tell him to go to hell. People like Josh Howard, who, you know, worked with him quite a bit. But, you know, he was tough, and he didn't hold on to people that well. A lot of times he was constantly badgering and calling, you know, I'm not sure this story is good enough, and pushing people harder and harder. But that questioning, that interview style, which I think he still stands out as one of the great interviewers of all time, if not the best, the directness, he brought that. Mm. he brought that. He had done a program, which you can see now, probably on YouTube, called Night Beat, which was a New York, local New York TV program that was all about that. And there's a comic routine by Sid Caesar where he's on that show and the sweat is pouring off him, you know, it's just soaking wet.
It's hilarious.
Being put on the spot by Mike Wallace. And, you know, so, you know, that I think is an important, when he got to CBS News as a correspondent, he didn't make much of a mark. In a way,
what was
he
the
was
difference
down.
Between Mike Wallace as a correspondent and Mike and difference between Mike Wallace as a correspondent and Mike Wallace as a correspondent on 60 Minutes?
Well, he's a lot like Don in those mid-60s, he was not succeeding. He was not cutting through. He didn't gain the respect.
Again, I had to prove something.
Yes. And those two together are what
so
you
fascinating.
Are calling that story of redemption. They both started, you know, and when they would argue with each other and, you know, be distant from each other, which was pretty common because they were rivals in the same way it's part of the Lennon and McCartney comparison.
Yeah.
That, you know, who's getting the most credit for this thing we created together?
Right.
You know, they would remind each other, we were both down and out when we started this thing.
Yeah.
How far we came.
You know, it's funny. You watch Seinfeld and then you see Larry David show Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And through Curb Your Enthusiasm, you see the underpinnings of Seinfeld and what make it so great.
It's true.
And the same with Lennon and McCartney, when they split up, you see kind of what Paul's penchant was.
You do.
And what Lennon's was.
Yeah, you do.
Now, you didn't see these two separated. So where did Don, what territory did Don have vis-a-vis Mike that Mike went, you know what, this is an area where I'm going to defer to Don. And what was the area where Don would defer to Mike?
Right. So this is the most important thing about Don, especially in the context of being a quote showman, is that he was a great editor. He was a great writer and he was a great storyteller.
But that's hard for, it sounds like a guy like Mike to have his stuff edited or
no,
he was okay with
fought,
that.
They fought, but he knew that Don had that.
Yeah.
And that Don had a vision for the broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
And so Don had the vision and he had the touch as an editor, which is really required in this job.
Mm.
You have to be able to make someone's story better.
Do you think he had that from the get-go or developed it over time?
No, he was a natural and he got better and better and better. And that was part of proving himself as a journalist.
Yeah.
But he was a natural writer. He was a very good writer. He was clever.
Yeah.
He had a vision for his broadcast and Mike respected that.
Yeah.
So, you know, any good journalist knows that you need a good editor.
Yeah.
And if that person can show you over a period of time, multiple times, that he's going to make your story better,
right,
you're going to defer to him. On the other hand, they fought like crazy in the screening room. And sometimes I would say and believe that it was show.
For the staff.
Yeah, they love to put on a show. They're feisty. They're slamming doors and yelling at each other. But a lot of it wasn't for show.
Yeah. And you got a great result out of it. This is how you describe Morley. Morley was a straight-talking, whimsical character, as strong and original as the other two, with an independent creative streak that would bring new ideas and new ways of doing things to the young broadcast. That has to be daunting for Morley to step into this relationship with Don and Mike. How did he do that? Was it seamless? Did he struggle at first?
He struggled mightily. Yeah. And, you know, remember, Morley was literally, he was in the London Bureau. He'd been in Vietnam a lot. He was the bureau chief in London. He sat at Murrow's desk.
Oh.
And so, and I think that he does qualify as a Murrow boy of the next generation.
And so how did Don feel about him given that?
Great. And he was so excited to bring him in. He needed that. And he, you know, Don was really good at finding what he said were people better and smarter than him, which we all laughed about because Don was as good and smart as it gets. But Morley got here and Mike started stealing his stories. And, you know, that to him was, that's not the way gentlemen correspondents behave.
Right.
So, you know, he was surprised. It was a bit of a nightmare. And they sat in offices next to each other. And, but Morley, I think, was motivated by that to build this Morley Safer story genre, which we now practice on a regular basis, but he built it.
How would you describe that?
Adventurous, well-written.
Always a touch of humor.
And, touch of humor, a touch of absurdity.
And I think it worked for him because if you don't know him, you just hear him speak, he comes off as a very dry, professorial in some ways. And then he's got this clever...
Beautifully written. And nobody could steal it from him because nobody could write like that. He had it.
Yeah.
And so, and it was important. And it's interesting because when, before Don asked Morley to come and join, he asked Charles Carroll to join.
Oh, who used to do the CBS Sunday Morning, Charles Carroll on the
Road. And before that, he did Charles Carroll on the Road for Walter Cronkite's Evening News, which was a much bigger place to be than 60 Minutes. He had his own gig. He had independence.
Yeah.
He didn't want to give that up.
Traveled the country in an RV. And by the way,
the Evening News, more than twice as big an audience as 60 Minutes.
Right.
Huge. Everybody watched the Evening News. 15 million viewers a night by 1972.
Unbelievable. And how do you go about over the years? You always seem, your correspondence just always seem to be right and seem to work. And what is your process for that? And how do the times affect who you choose in the, at that particular time?
It's a, you know, so much of it is Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours. You know, you don't get to 60 minutes if you're, unless you've got that level of experience.
Right.
And so everybody wants to come here. If you're a news reporter,
but that's makes your job. That's where you come in and how deft you are at. How do you make those choices? Because there are quite a good number of people out there with 10,000 hours who are there.
There are. So one of the things I think that you notice as you look at all the correspondents who have worked at 60 Minutes, they're unique in their own way. They bring something special, just the way Mike brought the tough interview. Morley brought beautiful storytelling. Bob Simon brought beautiful storytelling.
Yeah.
You know,
great shot of him walking away from like an oil with a tripod on his.
Yes. Yeah. That's the Gulf War. That's when Iraq blew up.
There's a picture out in the hall. It's a great shot of him.
Yeah. And losing him was huge, but
you
know, Anderson Cooper is such a unique figure.
Right.
He's, you know, they stand out for the various reasons. There's nobody as bland. It's not an easy decision to make to bring someone in. The most recent person we brought in was Bill Whitaker, someone who has experienced every kind of story in every part of this world.
What did you see in Bill that, what void did you feel as a personality and as a journalist, a correspondent, that he was, I assume you're trying to fill voids in that situation a little bit. What void did you see him filling?
Well, at that point we'd lost Bob Simon and, you know, I think, you need the ability to cover international stories. And Bill had done as Asian bureau chief and bureau correspondent over many years, had done that well. He had his 10,000 hours and he knew he'd experienced every kind of story there was. So as pure journalism, as a generalist, which is important to us, that you can cover every kind of story because that's part of our mix, he was a great choice and he's been incredible.
You have a funny thing Don Stewart said about when you stepped in. I'll let you say the quote about...
It was one of the... it was the Steve Croft profiling John Stewart, and it was my first fall in charge. And John said, you know, I like your program, but I don't really like your motto, your slogan. And Steve said, well, we don't have a slogan. And John said, yes, you do. Steve said, no, we don't. But what are you talking about? What is it? And John said, may cause drowsiness.
Were you aware of that coming in?
I thought about it when he said it. And I think, you know, because around here, that's fighting words. We pride ourselves in never being boring.
Yeah.
But I also realized that at that period, we were producing so many stories in advance of the season, almost half, almost 50%.
So you felt you lacked relevancy at times?
I did.
Yeah.
I think he was onto something.
Yeah.
And it was true that if you finish a story in August and it could run in March, that doesn't feel like news to me.
Yeah. And it starts to feel like, and the viewer's like, I kind of remember something. Yeah, I don't know. I got something else to do and they move on.
Right. So, you know, and I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to have half the stories done by the time we started a season, which is a riskier proposition.
Right.
You know, we literally sometimes can go from on a Monday morning, not know what we're going to have on the next Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
In terms of you stepping, was this Don's office where we're in right now?
Yeah.
Okay. This is why I love the book, because you really weave just some factual history, but personal experiences for you and others. This is the period from 2004 to 2008, it's page 260 of your book. You talk about coming into this office. Mm-hmm. Not until I actually moved into Don's office did I fully appreciate how jarring this would be for people. It wasn't that I was worried not being up to the job. You knew you could bring life to it. You looked forward to the challenge. But you say that it was a tough adjustment for you to be in this room. Mm-hmm. In this capacity?
Well, I think it was tough mostly for people who had to experience it and live with it. And, you know, there's a new boss. I mean, Don Hewitt, he's such a fixture.
Yeah.
You know, we always
say... Well, they say you don't want to follow the guy who's the guy.
Yeah, follow the guy who follows him.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it's funny because I think that, you know, we say nothing stays the same, but there are some things you expect might stay the same.
Yes.
And... however, it was time for him to move on, and eventually he realized that, but he didn't at the time. He said he wanted to die at his desk. You know, one of my favorite lines about that was Steve Croft. Just recently, I heard him say, we were up on a stage together talking about Don, and Steve said, you know, I remember him saying he wanted to die at his desk. Not me. I want to have a month off first.
How did the rest react? I mean, you were working here, so were you immediately welcomed in that position?
Yeah. I mean, they're friends and we'd work together and everybody was expecting this needed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't anybody else, you know, who was a candidate for the job.
Oh, there wasn't?
No.
There was, and you want to be internal with something like this. You don't want to...
You need knowledge. You need, you need someone who understands the place and how it works.
Plus, you're going to bring somebody in who's going to want to make their own imprimatur onto the show, and then start to try to change this thing.
Evolve it with the right amount of time. But the most important thing...
Well, evolve is one thing.
Yeah.
Radically change is a different...
And
you don't want to... You bring a person in from the outside, they're going to want to put their stamp on it.
And I didn't want to do that.
Right.
And so what happens in this situation as an editor, and it's part of what we were discussing earlier, is that if you're going to make someone's story better, you've won them over.
Yeah.
You know, and as soon as they started to notice that I could do that, that I can edit a story mm-hmm. pretty well, I can help you tell it better.
Right.
You've got them.
You gain credibility.
You do quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, at a place like this, there's no hiding. You know, everybody's exposed. It's an adult shop, and it's one of the great things about working.
Meaning
here.
Your work is seen and
critiqued regular basis.
This is another reason I love the book. The process that people go through here. There's two things. One is, why do you in the talk that I saw you give, you talked about minimizing narration and sound bites mm-hmm. in your pieces.
Yeah,
and why is that?
I don't like sound bites.
You feel it disrupts the flow?
No, I think that it becomes noise. It's like our broadcast, when it's at its best, is a collection of conversations.
Hmm.
And that's not always easy to do because people, and what I say about narrations, people tend to overpackage in television news.
Right.
And we try hard to not do that. And it's amazing how with fewer edits and more conversation, you end up with something that goes by a lot faster than something that's cut like
but
crazy.
But if you're interviewing a power broker, if you're interviewing a president, if you're mm-hmm. interviewing a big celebrity,
right,
that's the ice cream. In other words, doesn't the viewer want to hear that person talking as much as possible?
Yes, and that's what we want. So that's what we push for. I don't like them cut into a 12-second soundbite.
Right.
Make it a conversation.
Right.
You know, and so if you look at the broadcast when it's at its best, that's it.
Yeah.
You're hearing people talk. You're not cutting them off.
Right.
I can't stand it when an edit's made in the middle of a conversation and it feels like an edit.
Right.
You know,
meaning going back to the correspondent.
Yeah. And sometimes I think people, we like to take a narrow focus on a story.
Right.
And we like it to be more in depth on that narrow focus.
Mm.
Hear more from the people in your story. Mm. Have fewer people in your story. You know, package it less, you know, and by packaging, I mean, you know, what you see on a lot of newscasts are like 90-second stories that have narrations and soundbite and narration and soundbite. Then you see the reporter with a stand-up and then there's a close.
Right.
It's a formula.
Yeah.
And it's predictable.
Yeah.
And it becomes noise.
Yeah.
And what did I just see and hear? I'm not really sure.
This is why I love doing the podcast, because you can do a long form interview.
Yeah.
When you start... Every single conversation I do, and this isn't any thing because of me. You start somewhere and then you usually end somewhere else, or somewhere in the middle, you go off somewhere where you didn't expect.
Right.
And I think people should, through these interviews, get to know something about somebody they think they know.
Correct.
Or get to know somebody they don't know who I think they should know.
Right. So, Paul, it's one of those things every Monday morning, the compliment that I want to hear, that I love hearing, is when someone says, I didn't think I was going to be interested in
that.
And boy, did you suck me in. And boy, was it fast. I learned so much. And, you know, if they give us an hour of their time on a Sunday night at 7 o'clock, we better damn well give them something in return.
You say your one of, if not your favorite story, was about a breakthrough in cancer, fighting cancer.
Yeah.
What was that breakthrough and why was that favorite for you?
I think that, you know, we strive for impact.
Yeah.
You know, first and foremost, we like to have our stories matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a story about Duke and the doctors and scientists at Duke who had come up with an incredible idea of putting the polio virus, literally dropping it, a neutered version so you wouldn't get paralyzed by it, but dropping the polio virus into the worst kind of brain tumor, the glioblastoma, which is incurable.
Yeah.
And is a killer within 6 months usually.
That's what John McCain has right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Ted Kennedy.
Yeah.
We've lost people here on this floor from it. It's an awful, awful
brain cancer.
It's
so fast, once you have it.
And they had real success. So this is a cancer breakthrough. To me, that's about as important as it gets.
Yeah.
You know, you have a tumor that's shrinking to nothing. And a couple of people from that first test that are still alive and well today. My father was a brain surgeon. He never touched glioblastoma. He used to tell people with it, go have a nice vacation. Do something you've always wanted to do because you're not going to survive.
Wow.
And if he operated on it, maybe they'd live an extra month, but they'd be in chemo.
The quality of life is terrible.
No quality of life.
Yeah.
So the idea that that was happening, that that was possible, it's sort of like, you know, life on Mars. You know, it's like, I'll go with that story. You know, a cure for cancer. It's not a cure, but it sure looks like it's heading in the right direction.
Talking about decade five in the book, you say all 60-minute stories go through a thorough vetting process that typically catches mistakes. And you talk about the Lara Logan mistake. Talk about that process though and what happens in the screening room, which I think is really, really interesting.
Yeah, you know, people talk about our screening room a lot.
Yeah.
And it's an intense, intense place. And
because I'm going to interrupt you intentionally. I want people to understand who listen to this, it's the thing with TV or anything is like you turn it on and, oh, there's this thing and a few people just threw some stuff together and then they went and had some drinks. So, and they need to understand this process and how intricate it is.
And it begins with an idea.
Yeah.
And a lot of ideas get rejected. Some of them get accepted. And then a producer and an associate producer with a correspondent start working on it to make a real story of it. Well, that process to research and then to shoot and to do the interviews and then to edit it and to write it and then to bring it into the screening room averages about 3 months. So imagine you're putting that much of your life into a project that you're now going to show to us for the first time. Now, we've been talking about it all the way through, but as I said, it's a very adult shop. People need to be empowered to tell a story, to be creative. You know, we're not hovering over, you know, but then when they bring the story into the screening room, that's a nerve-wracking experience. You're so close to something.
And you will, I think you said you will listen first before you look at it.
No, but Don used to say that, and I watch the story, but I watch it as a viewer with fresh eyes. I haven't seen it, and you know, people know that that's the experience that they're going to get in terms of having worked on it so hard that they're showing it to me for the first time, and the senior staff at 60 Minutes, and we're going to have comments about the choices and decisions they made in the storytelling. And
how many people are in the room when this is happening?
Usually about 15 or 20.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, you're out there on a limb, you know, I tell the story about one of my screenings with Don Hewitt with Steve Croft, which is about Poland when the wall came down, turning to capitalism. And I'll never forget it. We worked on it for 2 or 3 months. The lights came on after Don saw it for the first time. And he looked at me and he said, where do you want a kid? Right between the eyes? You know, oh my God. You know, so that, yeah. But
I can remember John Stewart, that would happen with John Stewart. We'd do field pieces. And on average, the field pieces of The Daily Show were about 6 weeks. And Then John would go in with the correspondent and the producer, or whatever, and then they'd come out, a little ashen, you know, a little.
And you see that, and you see that here. I mean, you know, it's very direct in the screening room,
but always makes it better.
Yeah, we kick it around. We can argue about things. We disagree. It's a discussion. It's a collaboration, and that collaboration, I believe, is why when you tune in at 7 o'clock on Sunday, it usually looks like it belongs on 60 Minutes.
The one thing that you said you don't do here, which I didn't understand, is I think you said you get pitched about 3,000 stories or considered 3,000 stories a year.
Mm-hmm.
So you get pitched a lot.
We do 100.
Okay. And I can understand on one reason why you do this, another reason I don't. You don't give feedback on the pitches.
Yeah.
So I come to you, I pitch you something, I think it's great, my producer thinks it's great, you say no. I come and then no, another no. I get three no's, three say.
Right.
I don't have any guidance in terms of what you're looking for.
No.
So why don't you give feedback on the pitches so people kind of have a better idea of where they're not on the right track or what you think should be the right track.
Right. So if I did that to every pitch, that's all I would do.
Yeah, exactly.
So we say no, and Bill Owens is a big part of that. He says no, or I say no. The understanding on this floor is that if you feel really strongly about it, you come in and convince us why it should be done.
And is the pitch, these pitches are done orally or via paper first?
Paper. It's called a blue sheet. Yeah. And so if you really feel strongly, you've got great reporting, you think we're missing something, you come in and you make a case. Mm. And that happens a lot. But there are so many factors that go
into
saying.
People will come back. In other words, you say no to me and I'm like, listen, I really.
No, this is why you're wrong. All right. We should do it. And so, and that happens. And I love being proven wrong on that front.
Yeah.
What tends to happen is the criteria, and people realize this too, there are a lot of different criteria that we measure a story idea by. Some of it is that we've already got something similar in the works.
Right.
You know, some of it is that, maybe that isn't newsy enough, you know. Or, boy, with your abilities, we'd rather have you do something like this. So we do give feedback, especially when they push back.
Right.
But, again, if we, with all the ideas that come in, and we listen to every idea.
No, and I get it. You'd be whatever. It just struck me, you know, because I know when I pitch, it's like, okay, you know, you're in a vacuum and it's like, okay, well, what?
Right. But then I have bigger picture discussions with the staff as well.
So you have some direction.
Absolutely.
From that,
right? So at the end of last year's season, I commented to the whole staff gathered at, you know, our end of season event that we weren't doing enough in terms of this new administration. I thought we needed to do a lot more, you know, and there's 4 months in between when we end the season and when we started. And a lot of people started working on stories about the new administration.
It's funny. I was going to talk about this later, but let's talk about it now. This idea of fake news and has it, this is not to suggest that you haven't been diligent in terms of your journalism, the quality that you guys have and do and all of that. But like, has it kind of put you back on your heels a little bit? Are you doing an extra check here or there that you weren't doing? Or are you guys feeling like what we've been doing is right? And because we know the fake news thing is just nonsense, but I also know that there are some news organizations that are being very, very extra careful.
Yeah.
More so than they used to be.
No, we've made mistakes over the years, but our care is intense. I mean, you know, we try really hard to get it right. And that's a huge part of what we sell is our accuracy. That the president is saying that has not affected us one bit. And I think that the most important thing about fake news is he tends to call something fake news when he doesn't like it.
Yes.
But there is a real fake news problem in America.
Oh, sure.
And a huge part of it is on Facebook.
Yeah. And it had something to do with this current administration, this current president being elected.
Yeah. And, you know, so there is so much that's floating around there for not just political gain, but some of it for money that, you know, if you click on it, you know, someone's going to make money who created this story out of whole cloth and get shared by people who want to share things that they have in common.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a problem. And, you know, Facebook is answering it by saying we're going to, you know, redouble our efforts to, you know, monitor. And I think it's fundamentally an issue in terms of what what it is, what it represents.
Well, Facebook. There's also a very blurry line now with cable news. What's commentary and what's journalism?
Yeah, like, I have a problem with that.
I go on these CNN, MSNBC, Fox News as a panelist and talk issues, and I don't have any skin in the game, so I'm calling it on both sides, right?
Yeah.
But you know, I'm sitting there with somebody, and I was on a panel on Fox News with a gentleman, and this guy happened to be an African American Republican, mm-hmm. and Obama had said that the Constitution is a flawed document. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the formula over Fox News is anytime you see, you grab onto that, and then it just cycles through the day in every show.
Right.
And they're all sitting there going, "Oh, this is he shouldn't be our president." This is blah. And the African-American gentleman goes, "Yeah, the Constitution is written as a very perfect document." And I turned to him and said, "You can't say that because based on that document, you're a torso sitting here. You're 3/5 a person."
Yeah.
And it was sad for me because he couldn't see the objective argument through the color of his own skin.
Well, you know, it's interesting. That's such a good example, Paul, because that, you know, some of the cable channels have the similar problem to Facebook, which is that you're sharing things with friends and you're sharing things you know they want to hear. And so that's not journalism.
No.
And, you know, that's one of the reasons why, I mean, we go even further at 60 Minutes. We don't conduct audience research in terms of what to cover. You know, I mean, so
good
many
for
places,
you.
That's all they do. And that, and we feel very strongly about it. It's part of our value system, which is that we decide what to cover based mm-hmm. on the editors. And the onus is on us to make it so interesting that you have to watch it. You want to watch it. You don't want to leave it. So that's a fundamental difference from most of the news business. And this business of sharing and covering what your audience wants you to cover is a slippery slope.
And when you're doing this vetting process and you're in the screening room, has there tended to be a particular recurring issue or problem that you see initially when you screen stories fairly common throughout? I mean, I know there are probably multiple issues with a story, mm-hmm. but is there usually generally a common one that seems to pop up?
You know, we talk a lot about language, mm-hmm. and I think you've seen my forbidden words board, mm-hmm. which is right over here.
Yes.
And so.
And there literally is a chalkboard with words written that you are not allowed to have in your stories.
Well, and a lot of it is newspeak. So, you know, clearly is my best example. The word clear is used in almost every news story you'll ever hear. And the crazy thing about that is that nothing is clear in the world. It's all a little fuzzy.
Right, right.
But it's the way reporters are supposed to sound. You know, they say experts say a lot. They say officials say a lot. So the language is usually something that, and most people who've worked here for quite a while know, that we don't ever want to sound like a reporter is supposed to sound.
Right.
We want to tell a story to our viewer.
Do you want them to feel like the correspondent is you, like you and I are sitting here at a table, maybe we're at a bar having a drink, telling you this story about this issue, this breakthrough, whatever.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, as an example, we had a screening on Afghanistan, a story in Afghanistan. It's about Kabul, and it's about how dangerous and difficult Kabul's become.
Mm-hmm.
So dangerous that they can't drive from the airport to the American compound. They have to fly. That story to me is really, now the screening in that, the team ended up putting too many elements into it. And you lost that sense of what I just told you about.
Explain to people what you mean by elements.
Too many, trying to put too much into a story.
Too much information.
Yeah, too much information.
Too many visuals.
Too much of everything. Mm. As opposed to just start with that simple premise. That you can't drive from the airport to the compound.
Right.
You have to fly.
Mm.
It's, you know, 5-minute flight.
That's your structure, yeah.
It's a horrible, ridiculous situation. We've been fighting. It's the longest war in American history. That alone tells you so much about what's happened in Afghanistan. Let's focus on that.
Yeah.
And every other part of the story that comes out of it, and we're screening that story for the second time tomorrow. They've been reworking it, and you know, that's what fresh eyes brings to a story.
Mm.
You're in the middle of it. You're in the heart of it. You're collecting information on the ground mm-hmm. in Kabul, and you're trying to force too much into your mm-hmm. 12 and a half minute story.
Yeah. I want to sort of touch on one other thing about the book. This is the anecdotal part of it, which I think is really terrific. Mm-hmm. And I just love because you get to see behind the scenes of stuff. I remember seeing that on TV. Oh, that's what happened behind the scenes.
Yeah, good.
On page 62, you talk about Bill Clinton is going to have a conversation with his wife about Jennifer Flowers, with Steve Croft.
Yeah.
Stephanopoulos, who was his campaign advisor and manager at the time. And you say, Stephanopoulos wanted to make sure there would be some questions about policy, what Bill Clinton would do as president. Don Hewitt told him that would depend on how forthcoming the Clintons were about the topic.
Yeah.
And I think that's so fascinating that there's this negotiation going on beforehand.
Yeah, there always is, especially when you're doing a big interview. Mm. We don't allow anybody to set any conditions.
Mm-hmm.
We promise fairness, and I think our track record shows that we're going to deliver that.
Right.
But a lot of that happens, and you know, people try to keep. Look, he's running for president. He wants to make sure that with 35 million people watching.
It's a great picture here of the two of them. Boy, they just look like they just both got hit by a bus. It's so good. This book is so good. And then you say, Don described the interview. Kroft came at them every which way but Sunday, but they weaved, bobbed, and ducked and left the ring, I thought, unbloodied.
Yeah.
And then something happens that I feel, to me, does Don cross the line here to become advisor?
Mm-hmm.
On the next page, Don didn't think Clinton was leveling and told him during a break, I think at some point he said, you're going to have to be as candid as you know how.
Yeah.
That to me, it felt a little bit like, I understand he wants to get a great story, but it also felt like he was crossing the line and making news there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think he felt like Clinton was really dodging it.
Right.
And that, you know, being straight with the audience would be better for everybody, including the audience. And so, yeah, there's a little coaching going on there. No doubt about it. But it's also Don thinking, I want a headline here. You know, and you ain't giving it to me.
That's the show, man. That's the...
Yeah, absolutely.
Connected to that is... it's a great thing. After he does an interview, Clinton, as soon as it ended, Clinton shook hands, took pictures. Let's go in the kitchen and get some food. And you're there.
I do. I'll never forget. He said, let's go in the kitchen and get some food.
Which you thought like the last thing you were going to hear.
Well, yeah.
And then he gets a call from Hillary.
Yeah.
And describe that, because I think it so ties into the way she continues to be today.
Well, we went into the kitchen and in Chappaqua and their home, and there was a stack of sandwiches. Bill was still a little overweight and with a ton of sandwiches. And all of a sudden, you know, we started to talk, and he said, you know, someone came in with the phone and he said, excuse me, it's Hillary. And he went out with the phone and he came back about 15 minutes later. And he said, she thinks I screwed that up. She thinks I said too much. And he looked at me and said, you think I said too much? And I said, no, I thought you were terrific. You know, it was great.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's indicative in the sense that she was really chief of staff around him.
But that idea of hers that she had then, it made a connection to today.
No, it does, because she was always too careful.
And it's always been her issue.
Yeah.
And it's why she was so destructive, why she got the label Crooked Hillary. Like,
yeah.
You know, not that that was a bit of a reach on Crooked Hillary, but that's why you see windows into people
from
the history that through this show.
It's true. I wrote about later in the book where we interviewed her with the choice of her vice president, the first interview, Tim Kaine. And Scott Pelley asked about trustworthiness, which he said was a big issue for her. And she got so upset that he asked the question.
Right.
And said she didn't want to do another interview with Scott Pelley. But that is an example. Face it head on. Bill Clinton did that pretty well. And it was something, you know, Hillary was his political advisor and I think worked pretty hard to keep him from saying too much.
Mm.
And as her own political advisor, probably said too little.
As we wrap up here, the Anita Hill hearings, Hill accused Justice Thomas of sexual harassment and inappropriate behavior. And this is Ed Bradley. I sat there and I watched her and I wanted to believe her, but I don't understand how she could say nothing for 10 years. I don't understand how she could stay with him. And this is Bradley saying, this is what people are saying about this.
Right.
And this echoes exactly what's going on today.
Well, you realize how far we've come.
Yeah.
Because now I think we have real sympathy for someone who didn't say anything for 10 years.
Right.
because they felt intimidated or yeah. they worried about what the repercussions might be. Mm-hmm. She was a courageous woman.
Yeah. And yeah. It's just, it's so funny how you're seeing sort of things that are so relevant to today and almost yeah. repeating today almost in an exact way. The other thing that struck me, and this is in decade five toward the end of the book, there's an interview with Obama and he's asked, you know, what his weaknesses are, this and that. He said, I could have done better. You know, there's no doubt that probably at least once a week, maybe I say, I could have done better.
Yeah.
And I was so antithetical to the way Trump approaches things.
Yeah, well.
Which is everything's great and I'm perfect. Yeah. And I don't know, it just really hit home for me. It
did for me too. And I think because, and that's a picture from that interview, you see.
Oh, yeah.
The President Obama with his hand to his ear like a telephone.
Oh, yeah, it's in the book here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's saying, he's looking at me and Steve and saying, next week you won't take my call anymore. But, you know, some humility, and I don't think he was always a humble guy. I think he knew that he was pretty special
yeah.
intellectually.
Yeah.
But that humility really did resonate that day because he didn't only say that, he said, I said something in this interview I regret.
Yes.
I wish I'd had a chance to say again.
Yes.
And I'm always skeptical of people who say I have no regrets in life because I have so many. There are so many things you'd like to have over.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, that was a moment of reflection that I thought was really valuable.
Yeah, especially when you're like him and you spend a life in public and you're criticized by half the people that you worked for
tough, yeah.
all the time. If you had a job and 50% of the people who were your bosses, the American public, kept telling you you're lousy at your job, you're not keeping your promises. And he says here, this is Obama in the conversation, I think that there are some big obvious fumbles.
Yeah.
And I think if Trump weren't president right now, I'd be, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But that really stands out and speaks to not too many years later.
Yeah.
Where we are yeah. currently.
Well, I actually think that we'll see if it happens with President Trump, but that time in the office brings that humility.
And I don't think you're going to ever see that.
No, you probably won't. But the amazing thing about that and how intense the bashing is, mm-hmm. especially with social media amplifying it,
right,
is that I think Michelle really got fed up. She was
really?
Done. Done, done, done.
Is that something you just got a sense as a person observing from the outside or through sort of conversations?
No. Conversations. He said it in that last interview. He said as much because we thought she was going to be part of the interview. And we talked to them about that for months. And then the morning of the interview, we found out she wasn't going to be part of it.
And how did that all manifest itself for her? She just started to remove herself from the everyday?
There wasn't much contact between the president's press people and the first lady's press people, which surprised everybody.
Yeah, usually there is.
Well, I'm not sure. You expect that there is, right, Paul?
Right.
But so, but I think that she just never really wanted to do. We did the first interview as the president-elect with the Obamas. 25 million people watched it. It was a huge night.
Right.
And she did very well. That was the last interview she did on a broadcast like ours.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was just direct questions, you know, about mm-hmm. everything. She went on a lot of soft things.
Yeah.
But she was really, by the end, so ready to go and so sick of how she felt he was being treated.
Well, I guess you could, and you could also see, you could see that when she made that speech in the context of that Access Hollywood tape.
Yeah.
And she came out very forcefully against Trump. And I didn't remember ever hearing her be that forceful.
No, she tried to avoid that. At that moment, she knew she had to speak.
Totally get it now. Were you saying that you could, if I go back and look at that with this knowledge of her being fed up, you could see it.
Yeah.
You could just see it going, you know what? This is what I really feel. I'm sick of this.
Yeah.
This is nonsense and blah, blah, blah. And you got to hold back.
It's true.
50 years of 60 Minutes, an unbelievably great book. It's really, really terrific. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And how's the fishing going?
Yeah, well, I can't wait.
Yeah.
I don't fish until, you know, end of May.
Soon.
Yeah.
Soon.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah.
Every year I can't wait.
All right. Well, thanks for doing. And if you didn't hear the first Jeff Fager interview, go listen to that because you get a sense more of Jeff and his background and how he got here. So I appreciate you doing this again.
Thanks, great Paul. Great conversation.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. That was Mr. Jeff Fager. How great is that conversation? I could talk to him all day. It's just amazing the work that goes into making a show like that so great week in and week out. Hope to see you guys January 18th to the 20th in Edmonton, Canada at the Comic Strip Comedy Club. Just Google that. It's a great venue. Always a fun time. If you're in the area, come on out. I'd probably wear a hat and gloves. I'm just saying. It might be a little chilly.